Good morning. It is a good morning. My son and his family are over, and that means we have Pop-Tarts in the house. When Pastor Ben asked me to preach the Sunday after Easter, without any hesitation, I said, sure, yeah, that'd be great. And then this question hit me, wait a minute. What does somebody preach about the week after Easter? What did I do? But after thought and prayer, I've decided to continue where we left off last week, which was Matthew 28, and to focus on this little surprising detail we find in the second half of that chapter. But first, I want to relate a conversation that a friend of mine, Randy Newman, had with one of those Apple Store genius guys. He went in to buy a new laptop. And you need to know that Randy is, he's got this fancy title. He's a senior fellow of apologetics and evangelism at the C.S. Lewis Institute in Washington, D.C. So when the genius guy found out what Randy does, the conversation took a turn and the guy said, yeah, I used to be religious, Christian. What happened? Randy asked. I had too many doubts. I just couldn't be 100% sure. Oh, I've never been 100% sure, Randy said. Wait, what? I'd say most of the time I'm in the mid-90s. When it comes to how sure I am of my faith, when something terrible happens, I kind of dip down. But I'm never at 100. Maybe you're surprised at Randy's answer. Maybe you're not. But this morning, we're going to explore doubt. We don't talk about it all that often. Whether you're a follower of Jesus, an almost follower of Jesus, a skeptic, feelings of uncertainty, doubts, are something that we all experience. So let's get to our passage. Last week, we read the first 10 verses of Matthew 28, where Matthew describes the chaos, literal chaos, of the resurrection. And we heard from Pastor Ben last week that the resurrection gives us hope for our lives now and for all eternity. But I want to focus on the experience of the disciples in how they reacted or responded to the resurrection, which I think will help us find freedom and strength in our faith. So last week's passage, if you remember it, or you can turn to, I don't have the page number. I should. Sorry, folks. But Matthew 28. The first half that we looked at last week, it's full of drama. You've got earthquakes, angels that look like lightning, Roman guards freaking out in panic, pretending to be dead men, so maybe those fearsome angels won't even notice them. They're standing just a few feet away. Mary Magdalene and her friend experience this full range of emotions. It says from fear to joy at the sight of the angel, and then again when they see the risen Jesus himself. And then that passage ends with some closing instructions from Jesus to the women to go tell the other 11 disciples, hey, meet me on a mountain in Galilee. Passage ends. So now we pick up from there and we read the next 10 verses, which I believe are up here. I want to make sure I have the same. You know what? I'm going to read it from here. While they were going, behold, some of the guard, while they, that is the women, were going, behold, some of the guard went into the city and told the chief priests all that had taken place. And when they had assembled with the elders and taken counsel, they gave a sufficient sum of money to the soldiers and said, tell people his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. And if this comes to the governor's ears, we'll satisfy him and keep you out of trouble. So they took the money and did as they were directed. And this story has been spread among the Jews to this day. Now the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. And when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. And Jesus came and said to them, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you, and behold, I am with you always to the end of the age. Is there a water that... I should have brought myself a water. Sorry about that. But There's a lot going on in this passage, and it kind of splits up nicely into three sections. The first five verses, 11 to 15, give us this concocted story. Thanks, Mary. Give us this concocted story that the disciples stole Jesus' body. And we're not really going to focus on that much today, other than to say, number one, it makes no sense. And number two, while that story was relevant in the first century, just so you're not confused, it's not a thing today in the Jewish community. Nobody is passing this story on anymore. But I like this quote from Chuck Colson, special former counsel for President Richard Nixon, commenting on the idea that the disciples might have stolen the body of Jesus. He said, "I know the resurrection is a fact, and Watergate proved it to me. How? Because 12 men testified that they had seen Jesus raised from the dead. Then they proclaimed that truth for 40 years, never once denying it. Every one of them was beaten, tortured, stoned, and put in prison. They would not have endured that if it weren't true. Watergate embroiled 12 of the most powerful men in the world, and they couldn't keep alive for 3 weeks. You're telling me 12 disciples could keep it for 40 years? Absolutely impossible." I love that. Well, the second section of our passage, verses 16 and 17, connects with last week's story as Jesus meets his disciples up on the mountain in Galilee. We don't know what mountain that is, but most people take their best guess and say it was probably a mountain called Mount Arbel, which is about 7.5 miles from Capernaum, about 2 miles from Magdala, where Mary Magdalene was from, on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. And it's the most rugged peak in the area compared to all the hills around it. And from that panoramic view on top of Mount Arbel, it's an amazing context because you can feel like you see forever other nations outside of the boundaries of Israel. It's a great location for the Great Commission, which we see at the end of our passage. Well, this morning, as I said, we're going to focus primarily on the middle section of our passage, and in particular, the response of the disciples when they see the resurrected Jesus. But first, we got to give a little bit of background that leads us up that mountain. So these 11 guys have been following Jesus for 3 years. And during those years, especially the last year, Jesus had to correct their view of what the Messiah was supposed to do. Just when you think Peter gets it right, he actually gets it wrong. So what I'm referring to is in Matthew 16, just prior to our passage a little bit, Jesus asked Peter who Peter thinks Jesus is. And he answered, "Well, you're the Messiah, the Son of the living God." Well, all good, right? Well, actually, that's when we get our first clue that they really didn't understand who Jesus was and why he came and what the Messiah was supposed to do. Matthew tells us that Jesus began in that moment to teach them about his impending death for sin, that he was going to suffer, that he would rise from the dead. And then Peter listens to him and he says, "No, Jesus, I don't think so. That's not going to happen to you." Why did he protest like that? Why so passionately? Like, "No way, Jesus, that's not happening to you." Because he had all the wrong ideas about what the Messiah was supposed to do. In the first century, Peter had, he was just, you know, a resident of the land there, just like everybody else. Everybody wanted a Messiah who was going to come and beat the Romans, get rid of our enemies, bring peace on earth. That was the popular view of the Messiah. Look, I guarantee it, if we took a vote and we got to choose what kind of Messiah we wanted, we will always choose Superman. We will never choose Clark Kent, right? So that's where Peter's head was at. That's where the whole culture and the society was at that time. And Jesus, knowing that, he's like, "I don't need any premature messianic battles on my hands." So Jesus does two things there. First, he told Peter, "Yes, you're right. I'm the Messiah." Now, and he says, "Don't tell anyone." That's kind of unusual because he didn't want this, you know, to swell and get out of hand. Secondly, it says he immediately began to teach his disciples that he was going to suffer, die for sin, and be raised from the dead. And from that point through the end of Matthew's gospel, we see him teaching this over and over and over again, but the disciples just don't seem to get it. So when they meet with him up on the mountain and we discover that some doubted, we really shouldn't be so surprised. What should surprise us is that Matthew, who wrote this whole gospel, that he decides to insert this awkward little detail. I mean, this guy Matthew's been writing this book to convince the Jewish community, or perhaps to encourage the Jewish believing community at that time, that Jesus is the Messiah, who he claimed to be. He spends pages and pages telling the life of Jesus, and then he gets to the climax, and at this climactic moment where he should be putting the icing on the cake, he slips in this little detail: some of the disciples doubted. What kind of a writer does that? Honestly, an honest one. And I love it. I love that Matthew did that because it's one more piece of evidence about the honesty of the Bible, about the honesty of the authors of the Bible, and this little detail adds to the authenticity of the New Testament record. So let's take a sec to think through why the disciples might have doubted. Craig Blomberg, a distinguished professor emeritus from Denver Seminary, he gives three possibilities. Number one, maybe it was something about Jesus' appearance was different, and so they weren't sure it was him. It's possible, maybe he was hard to recognize. Number two, maybe because they were Jewish, they hesitated, wondering, I'm paraphrasing from Blomberg here, is it really kosher to worship anyone but the unseen God? You know, that would, being Jewish, that seems maybe a bit over the line. When I was a brand new believer, about 2 months in faith, I went home and my parents called my uncle over. He was a rabbi, so that the two of us could go down to the basement and he was supposed to straighten me out. And in that conversation, he asked me a bunch of questions, and I knew about that much. And he said, what do you believe about Jesus? Do you believe he's God? And honestly, in that moment, I didn't even know. It's like, I knew he was the Messiah who died for my sins. He fulfilled messianic prophecy. Did I believe he was God? I was like, wow, I don't know. I've never even thought about that. But even though I didn't know the answer clearly, I didn't know about the deity of Christ at that point, I knew to even consider saying yes to my uncle, the rabbi, would have been outrageous. It just would have been very inappropriate. So maybe that's what they're feeling. Third option from Blomberg, maybe they're simply confused, and this is his words, how to behave in the presence of a supernaturally manifested, exalted, and holy being. That makes sense. Now, those are all decent options about maybe why they were hesitating, doubting, but I have a fourth option. And my option is that the disciples were simply human, and therefore they were predisposed to have a mix of faith and doubt. Was there something wrong with those disciples and their faith, that in this big moment they doubted? I don't think so. Show me a Bible hero who didn't doubt. Now, we're going to put up on the screen here, you can see that, all these Bible heroes, and there's the chapters that'll kind of show you their doubt. I thought I was going to go through all these, and then I got a little worried about the time, so I don't know that we will, but I'll mention maybe a couple from the Old Testament, a couple from the New. Adam and Eve, when the serpent contradicted God's instructions to them to not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, suggesting God might want to just deprive them of knowledge somehow, they began to doubt God's intentions and wondered, does he really have our best interests in mind? Abraham and Sarah, after God promised them a biological child, They doubted it could happen, and with nothing to show after 25 years, they nervously laughed as they internally questioned, can God give us children? Let's skip down to John the Baptist, the forerunner of the Messiah himself, who announced his coming, who baptized Jesus. When he's all alone in prison, alone with his thoughts, he began to doubt, have I believed the right things about Jesus? And he sent a messenger to go ask, are you really the one we've been waiting for? And then, of course, we all know about Thomas. We've just heard a song about Thomas. Having missed Jesus' previous appearances to the other 10 remaining disciples, he was told by them that after being crucified, Jesus was alive. But he doubted, implicitly wondering, can I trust what other believers tell me? I encourage you, if you know, on your own time, to read all these stories. There are times that all of us get a feeling of uncertainty and we begin to question some of our beliefs. But we don't often like to admit it, choosing instead to keep those things to ourselves. We hide behind a thin veneer of cheerfulness while maybe inside we're feeling a bit hurt and doubt, you know, doubting. Being in full-time ministry, as I am, there's a particular pressure. If I admit my doubts and my uncertainties, aren't I going to hurt those that I'm ministering to? What would happen if you admitted yours? Growing up Jewish, I was taught that questioning things is a good thing. It's permitted. It's even healthy to do. And interestingly, as I was looking around for things and thinking about this message, I found a 2009 study done on the consequences of religious doubt. And the researchers found a lot of things, but one was that suppressing religious doubt has an adverse effect on physical health. Very interesting. So it's not good to keep it down and keep it buried. This verse that we just sang from Come Thou Fount, prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. I didn't grow up in the church, and when I first came across this song, compared to all the other songs that we would sing in church, I resonated with this song. I thought, this song is one of the most honest Christian hymns that I've seen so far. Prone to wander, prone to doubt. But Robert Robinson, who penned this song in 1757, he had the guts and the humility to admit his weakness and his doubt. And folks, I love him for it. Our faith is validated and even strengthened as we sing this song, we identify with his personal self-disclosure, and we make it ours. We shouldn't fear our doubts. My wife, when I was sharing that line with her, and she said, yes, but we should never doubt our fears. But I said, wait a minute, no, I don't think that's right. But we shouldn't fear or avoid our doubts. Doubt is not the enemy of faith. In a sense, I'm telling you this morning, it's part of faith. If we had total certainty about everything, where would there be room for faith? Again, drawing on my Jewish background, there's this thing called the 13 Articles of Faith. It was written in the 12th century by one of the most famous and influential rabbis, Maimonides. We call him Rambam. And it's all these things we're supposed to, I believe God created everything. I believe God has no body, Messiah, all these things. And each one of them start out with, I believe with perfect faith, fill in the blank. I believe with perfect faith, fill in the blank. The only problem is that there's no such thing as perfect faith. No such thing. Human faith is as flawed as human health. It's as flawed as human politics, human psychology, human relationships. All human experience is impacted by sin and a broken world. This includes our faith as well. Doubt is part of normative human experience. It's unavoidable, and it crops up at inconvenient times usually, like a life crisis, something with our health, something with our finances, a natural disaster, a big disappointment, a disorienting first exposure to some new information we've never seen before previously. A year ago, so it's very recent, the Barna Group conducted a study about the things that cause Christians to doubt. And these are Christians who are not just Christmas Easter Christians. These are people, they had to go to church, you know, regularly kind of thing to count for this study. So here's what they found, some of the common causes of Christian doubts. We'll put that up on the screen now. Oh, it's already there. I'm looking there. It's not up there, but it's there. I'm glad. All right. Interesting to see, and I wonder as you look at this, if you see yourself somewhere. Have you wrestled with some of these things? Maybe. I'll bet some of us have. The Barna study revealed that 40% of practicing Christians report experiencing frequent to occasional doubts about their religious beliefs. And 50% say they've gone through a prolonged period of doubt at some point in their life. And as I look around, I just have to assume that this applies to some of us this morning. There's an author and a theologian, a writer, Oz Guinness. He wrote a book when I was in college called In Two Minds that takes a deep dive into the subject of doubt. And he says this, doubt is not the same as unbelief. So it is not the opposite of faith. Rather, it is a state of mind and suspension between faith and unbelief. To believe is to be in one mind about accepting something as true. To disbelieve is to be in one mind about rejecting it. And to doubt is to waver somewhere in between the two, and thus to be in two minds. This important distinction uncovers a major misconception of doubt. The idea that a believer betrays faith and surrenders to unbelief by doubting. He goes on to say, doubt is not unbelief. It is not terminal. It is only a halfway stage that can lead on to a deepened faith as easily as break down to unbelief. So, what can we do about our doubts? How can we handle them? First, recognize the difference between doubt and unbelief, as Guinness would remind us. Next, look for answers. Look for the best answers. In his new book, Questioning Faith, Indirect Journeys of Belief Through Terrains of Doubt, which I recommend highly, I just read it, my friend Randy Newman wrote this. If some stories in the Bible seem too far-fetched to accept, we should consider that we're not the first ones to have this impression. We should see what the best scholars have to say. Look, don't be afraid to look at the hard questions, to examine them, and to seek answers. Reach out to others who can help, maybe people who have been in the faith longer than you. Ask someone to help you. After all, we're told to carry each other's burdens. This includes the doubts we carry. They feel like burdens in our heads sometimes. When, hearkening back to when I was a new believer again, I was just before I had that experience with my uncle, I wrote my parents like a 10-page, single-space letter to tell them all about my faith. You know, this zeal you have, and I wanted to, hadn't been communicating with them that much for a little while before that. And as I'm writing this letter, all of a sudden, I had this wave of sort of panic and uncertainty sweep over me, like, oh no, what if this thing that I came to believe and then I'm telling my parents about, what if it's all fake? What if I've just kind of embraced some kind of psychological trip, something, you know, what? And I felt like somebody had just pulled the rug out from under me. Literally, I was almost shaking. And the only thing I knew to do is I called a friend of mine, Lanny Penwell, who was a few years older. He was in full-time ministry. I was volunteering with the organization, and I said, Lanny, I need to talk. Come over. And he came over. We drove around, and for I don't know how long. You know what we talked about? Or I didn't talk. You know what he talked about? He talked about the resurrection and all of the evidence for the resurrection, that it wasn't just a psychological trip. And by anyway, all I know is by the end of that car ride, that I was no longer sweating. I was no longer shaking. I felt a lot better. So it's helpful to talk to other people. Over the years, and maybe you want to try this sometime, I don't know, I've created in my mind this invisible doubt box, okay? So when a thought arises or a question arises and, you know, makes me feel uncertain or I don't know how to answer it, I now have enough experience over the course of my life as a believer that I don't panic. I just kind of put that question in that box and figure, okay, I've had a lot of my questions and doubts addressed and answered through the years. I can be patient. Maybe I'll get an answer to this one. Maybe I won't. So I just kind of keep it in suspension in my mind. You know, I've been satisfied many times with what I've discovered. Sometimes, as I said, I'm still waiting for others. It's okay to hold things in tension without an easy resolution. If somebody told you Christianity is like the easy religion, they were lying or they were mistaken. It's okay to hold things in tension. We don't have all the answers. Part of this waiting, of course, is to admit our doubts to the Lord. He can handle it. He's been handling it for all of human history. Speaking of that, when you read the Bible, look for questions and questioners. As you saw in that previous slide, they're all over the place. The Older Testament, the Newer Testament, they're all over. You find yourself in good company, which should encourage you. God didn't reject them, and he won't reject you for your imperfect faith. Here's another thing. Hold your doubts lightly. Rent them. Don't own them. The cost of ownership can be quite high. In fact, when a doubt comes up in your mind, don't fear it. Doubt it. Doubt your doubts. What do I mean by that? Well, you know, we know what it means to doubt our faith. We never think about doubting our doubts. You know, question your doubts. See if they hold up under scrutiny. Let your doubts become a stepping stone to a deeper, tougher faith. Realize that every person on the planet, atheists, believers, scientists, janitors, everybody has doubts and questions. When I was in college, I took a course called, two semesters, Physics for Poets. What it was all the concepts of physics without having to do the math. So that was perfect for me. And the professor one day in this large lecture hall was talking about cosmology, you know, the origins of the universe. And he was talking about the Big Bang Theory. And I'm no expert on the Big Bang Theory, but you've got to... Is somebody here an expert on the Big Bang Theory? Okay, good. I don't have to worry. Anyways, something about gases and matter and, you know, really tiny, the head of a pin, boom, and then it all exploded and we have the universe. Okay, that's reductionist description. But anyway, when he got done, I raised my hand and I asked, where did all the matter and the gases come from? And this is in a big lecture hall, and the guy, the scientific professor, just stood at the bottom of, you know, in the front of the class, and he said, God, you know. He didn't have an answer. Everybody has doubts, questions. You can be a scientist. You can be a religious person. This is interesting. The California legal system, and I suppose every state does this, they provide guidance for juries, how to find someone who's on trial, how to determine if they're guilty based on a reasonable doubt. If it's beyond a reasonable doubt, we've all heard that term before. And they say this, proof beyond a reasonable doubt is proof that leaves you with an abiding conviction that the charge is true. Here's the key. Then they say, the evidence need not eliminate all possible doubt, because everything in life is open to some possible or imaginary doubt. How true is that? We can doubt almost anything, including aspects of our faith. But we can also, after examining the evidence, come to an abiding conviction of the truth of our conclusion. Doubt pushes us to seek answers. Doubt can and should lead to spiritual growth. Doubt also helps us relate to others, because when we're open about our doubt and our questions, we make ourselves approachable. Doubt keeps us humble and prevents us from being arrogant know-it-alls. Don't get me wrong, I'm not advocating doubt this morning like it's the best thing since sliced bread. I'm simply acknowledging it as part of life that we don't need to be afraid of and that we don't need to hide. So let's finish up. Let's take our final look at Matthew 28. The resurrected Jesus is standing in front of his disciples, but this is not the first time he's done so. Between Resurrection Sunday, when Jesus directed Mary and the other women to tell the disciples to meet him on the mountain in Galilee, he had already appeared to all of them several times. That's something we don't think about. The mountaintop meeting is actually the third or fourth time, yet some are still doubting. But the reaction didn't catch him by surprise. When we think of the post-resurrection doubt, we always like to point to the most famous doubter of all, and we like to sing about him, right, Ilya? Thomas. He had his, unless I see it with my own eyes and put my hand in his side, I ain't gonna believe. But in Luke 24, verse 38, there's this little thing we kind of gloss over sometimes. We read that Jesus appeared to all the other 11 disciples, and he says to all of them, why do doubts arise in your hearts? It wasn't just Thomas who doubted. Jesus knew them, the disciples, and he knows us. He knows what's in our heart. He knew that some on that mountain would doubt, but you know what? He didn't exclude them from being invited to meet him up there. And from their point of view, the disciples who doubted, they didn't avoid climbing up that mountain shoulder to shoulder with the others. These disciples didn't have all the answers. They didn't understand what to expect. They didn't fully understand Jesus, but they showed up anyway. Then, without wondering if it's the right moment, or whether this group of disciples is ready, Jesus gives the Great Commission, telling them, all of them, go into the world, spread his teaching, and baptize believers into the faith. They were all commissioned, all called to his mission in the world. He knew they didn't need to, nor could they have all the answers, but he knew that they could step out and speak up to share what they did understand about him. Folks, the point is this. God knows we'll never have all the answers, at least on this side of heaven. Only he has all the answers. God knows that we all, believer and non-believer, wrestle with feelings of uncertainty. The good news is that Jesus knows us, doubts and all. Just as he called the disciples, he calls us to believe, to follow, and to tell others what we've experienced and learned about him. Let's pray. Lord, thank you that you do know us. The light, the darkness, the good, the bad, the mixed, the uncertain, the certain. Lord, as the psalmist said, there's nowhere we can hide from you, nor do we want to hide from you. Thank you that you love us, and we can be confident of that. Lord, thank you for this story that allows us to know you and the disciples more and to reflect on who we are in you. I pray for each one of us that you will help us to sort through all of our thoughts and to entrust them all to you, knowing that you can sort it all out for us and with us. Help us to be real people in the real world you've created, and to love others and share you. In Jesus' name, amen.